Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Beyond Packaging. I'm Laura Foti.
I'm Matthew Wright, the still the co-host.
Still the co-host. People have been messaging me saying you're doing great.
No, I heard the same thing. I heard you carrying the show.
Now, you know, I was actually thinking about this. Remember when we wrote the book, The Evolution of Products and Packaging?
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was like, hey, I want you to do the audio version.
It's a disaster.
And you're like, sure, I'll do the audio version.
Never
I'm like,
again.
Okay. And you showed up to the recording, like with already no voice.
Yeah.
Where did you come from?
Vegas, but that's a different story. But no, never doing an audio book again in my life.
Like this guy, I told him, I'm like, hey, on this date, you're going to record an audio book. And you decide to go to Vegas the day before.
I've never said the 20 times in a row to try to get it right. So,
well, you're doing great. No, we have a lot to talk about today. Diving into some packaging news. One thing that's near and dear to your heart, Matthew, I know how much of a wine fan you are. Target just unveiled a new wine collection that comes in paper bottles. And it's changing more than just packaging. This was in Food and Wine magazine. This is called Collective Good. And it features four global varietals priced at $9.99 each and includes wines from Italy, Spain, Chile, and California, available in 1,200 stores. They're packaged in what's called the frugal bottle. It's a recyclable paper bottle made from 94% recycled materials. The packaging is 5 times lighter than glass and reduces carbon emissions by up to 84%. I mean, Matthew, has anything been done like this before?
No, first of all, wine and wino is very close to each other. So yes, I like wine. No, I think it's great innovation. We talked about wine packaging the other day, spent a lot of time in this space years ago, and it was really hard to break out of the feeling that a bottle, a true wood cork gives you. So in a lot of histories, obviously a product goes thousands of years back, right? So innovation is just starting to hit the space. I think the part of that article I found most fascinating is 5 times lighter. I mean, that's, you don't, people understand about glass is how heavy it is, how much energy it takes to move that product around. So I think that's the coolest part. And then secondarily, back to us that like wine, a bottle generally doesn't last a long time. So I don't think we have to worry about it being a cap and closure for, you know, holding it for weeks or months. I think we're worried about a day.
You know, I think the thing that struck me the most about this is I would say a few years ago when we talked to companies about packaging sustainability, there was this perception of it meant more expensive. If you were going to be sustainable, you had to increase your cost of goods. You had to increase or pass it on to the consumer. But it seems like at a $9.99 price point, they've clearly figured something out.
Well, and I haven't studied enough, but I'm assuming the transportation, I just said, you know, moving glass bottles around is very expensive and very hard to do. So I'm assuming this product obviously collapses, probably lots more in a trailer load. You know, there's a lot of economics besides just the product itself. So yeah, I think the supply chain obviously is starting to support innovation and doing it at a lower cost.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. I feel like all the news topics are around packaging sustainability, but that feels pretty obvious. In similar news, Kind launches a fully recyclable paper wrapper, pioneering a new era in snack packaging. The brand's second paper wrapper pilot will be available at select Whole Foods markets across the U.S. You know, Matthew, I was at Expo West a few weeks ago, and it does seem like there's just a lot of momentum on this that didn't exist a few years ago.
Yeah, we were at an amazing packaging company back east a couple of weeks ago. And they were doing a tremendous amount of work around technology and paper packaging. And really, quite frankly, the graphics have just gotten phenomenally good, almost arguably better. I would just say that the caveat to all that is we also got to make sure we get rid of it differently. And I think we still got to spend a lot of time on the downstream waste side of making sure it doesn't end up in the same place that its counterpart does. And then when you do that, it's just a really cool solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, last up for today, but certainly not least, Washington State has advanced extender producer responsibility legislation following collaborative development. And so they're starting to talk about new elements of the law, which would say by 2026, January, each producer of packaging and paper products would appoint a producer responsibility organization. You know, Maryland's recently passed. It feels like there just continues to be traction on this front.
Yeah, no, it's going to continue. We all know that. You know, we're going from 4 or 5 states to 50. I think over the next 12, 24 months, this is again about getting rid of waste. This is not a social political element as much as it is a challenge for these states to really economically continue to dispose of the amount of waste and find better ways to do that. So Washington's obviously a state that's a great state from a green perspective per se, but they're all coming. They're all moving this direction.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, listen, I have a list of all the laws and I feel like I'm constantly adding to it. In fact, they no longer all fit on my PowerPoint slide. We had to put them into this giant Excel spreadsheet. So,
I don't remember if you remember a couple of years ago, you were talking about the topic. And I said, nobody's really the standard resident expert. You've really become an expert over the last couple of years.
You know, I appreciate you saying that. I've always said with sustainability, I always felt like everyone was looking for one person who knew all the answers. And I just don't think that's ever going to be the case. I think, you know, we're so fortunate to partner with people like Michelle from Lorax and Corey Connors, who has his sustainable packaging podcast. I mean, in order to get really educated on this topic, you have to be getting your information from a lot of different people who are looking at the problem from different sides.
We're changing the world. Not one person can change the world. We need everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of which, we have a special guest with us today. I'm thrilled to welcome Matt Reynolds to the podcast. He is the editor-in-chief of Packaging World and really one of the industry's preeminent thought leaders. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I don't know about preeminent thought leader, but I'll try and keep up with you two at least.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Well, years ago, I remember my first Pack Expo. It was the first time I was exposed to packaging, like the packaging industry. And I remember walking in and just my whole world just shifted in terms of like what packaging was. And I remember meeting you in person and it's just been really fun learning from all the work that you've done. So excited to chat today. Matt, you just published a major survey on digital transformation across consumer goods companies. Would love for you to share with our listeners some of the results.
Yeah, so this was a survey. It was a first time ever survey. So we don't really have year over year data. That's the hope, is to do this annually. And then over time, we'll start to be able to extrapolate some trend lines. What we have now for this year, and it was data collected between July and October, I think, of 24. So still reasonably fresh. But then we have a snapshot. We don't really have the trend lines, but it's an opening salvo. What we wanted to do is just try and understand, first of all, whether our audience, which are largely CPGs, brand owners, some contract packagers in there, understood what digitalization or digital transformation was. And by and large, that was our first question. It was almost like a weed out question to make sure they understood the water in which we were planning on swimming. Everybody, I mean, in our consumer lives, we are experiencing digitalization, and we're streaming. You know, we're streaming right now, as opposed to some sort of analog device. So people understand it, they get it, but then we found that a remarkable few of our brand owner audience actually are understand what their companies are doing. Only 25%. So 75%. I think 40% of our respondents just said that their companies don't have a digitalization strategy or don't have a digital transformation strategy. 35% said they don't know. So that's three quarters are just kind of weren't sure. 25%, probably some of the more sophisticated amongst our readers, they indicated they did have a digitalization strategy. So wow. That was surprising to see. That was the starting point, at least. So one of the things that we found, though, is there seems to be an order of operations for digitalization as it sweeps across an organization, again, CPG brand owner. And it starts on the business side of things, the broader business elements, ERP software, for instance, and digitizing that. And think about it, you're replacing, in a sense, an Excel sheet in that sense, as opposed to a piece of equipment that might cost $1 million and is expected to be running for 30 years. So I think there's an experience of on the manufacturing side, particularly packaging, the furthest downstream, trying to turn, you know, an aircraft carrier where they can be more nimble on the software side of things. So those are just some early findings from our survey.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, to your point, it's great insights, Matt. It's really exciting, you know, people talk about the manufacturing supply chain space is kind of the open form wild west left in technology. And a lot of it's just what you just said is the digitization and how far kind of we are behind the rest of the world. You just mentioned, and I say it all the time, the rest of our life, we live in the digital world, you know, whether it's mapping technology, you know, software to schedule us, all this is technology that's digitized already. And so it's interesting to see the world moving in this direction, but a lot of work left to be done, for sure.
I mean, we see that firsthand, Matt. Like when you said spreadsheets to an ERP. I mean, we see that with spreadsheets with specifications for not just the packaging, but the ingredients and the formulas and sending that out via email. I think the thing that's shocking to me that I would challenge all of our listeners on is if your company doesn't have a digital transformation strategy, you don't have a business strategy. I mean, that's just the world we live in. I can't imagine, like, no matter which way you slice it, like workforce challenges, all the reporting now for packaging sustainability and EPR. I mean, if you don't have a digital approach to solving these challenges, I mean, it's just going to be impossible to keep up with the pace of change.
Yeah. I mean, you look at like the tariff, issue today, and it doesn't really matter the outcome of that per se in this conversation. It's that the complexity for business continues to rise. The state-based ingredient expectations, you know, the multi-leveled country expectations. You got to be able to parse your information down, and data is what does it.
You know, Matt, you know, your report really showed that the digital transformation has started with ERP and supply chain, but that packaging and really packaging manufacturing are next. Why do you think that packaging is still lagging when it comes to digitalization?
There's a lot of reasons. I think, especially coming out of the pandemic, I mean, there's cycles to business and there's cycles of innovation that happens, but more recently with inflation, cost pressure, low margins, I think a lot of companies have been forced to focus on productivity, cost savings, demand planning, streamlining where they can on the business side of things, streamlining business practices versus packaging innovation. But there's, like I said, there's cycles to that. There's equipment that's aging out all the time. So that's one reason that we saw it happen, the low hanging fruit of swapping from Excel to an ERP was more attainable more quickly, maybe than switching or adding sensors and collecting data with a whole MES system on the manufacturing side of things. Also, even within manufacturing, there's an order to this, and it seems like the processing side is happening first. The upstream processing is experiencing digitization more quickly. There's a lot more equipment there. There's a lot more, it can be 7-to-1 or more assets that are upstream, and there's more expertise up there. I mean, that, you know, if you're Smucker's, that's your core product, you know a lot about that. And then the packaging is a little bit more commoditized comparatively. So it's just kind of flowing downstream. And right now I think packaging is next to really, to be the next place for digitalization to make a big impact. It's already started, but it's starting to sweep over.
We totally agree. I mean, Matthew, you see this firsthand. What are your thoughts?
I'm right along with Matt. And I think in terms of like just order of priorities and expectations, and you got a couple of different influences. One is we have, which won't spend a lot of time on today, the whole workforce generational change that's coming, which is, you know, it's going to expect a digitized data kind of job application to whatever they're doing. The second piece is, as you just talked about, the wine bottle change, is just this rapid product change. So Matt, you mentioned a few minutes ago, like historically you came up with a product, you ran that product for 30 years on that equipment, and you kind of had that big cost infrastructure around you. Today, you know, we have to be nimble. We have to change. We have to move quickly because things are going to keep changing. And I think companies start to realize that's not just a capital issue. That's a data issue. They got to go together.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm thinking back to Spec Summit where we had one of our favorite people talk about packaging. He works at a beauty brand. And he was mentioning how last year he didn't really launch that many new products with packaging. He went back and optimized all the packaging. And we're seeing more of that too, where it used to be you would design a package, it would kind of go into like the product life cycle of it would eventually phase out. But now with demands around, okay, tariffs, we got to move our packaging, we got to change suppliers, or we have to be more sustainable. Packaging has changed, seems to be changing a lot more than it used to.
I feel, Matt, I'd love your thoughts on this. I was given this comment the other day. I really think that the packaging's rising to the C-suite of companies, and it has to. It's so symbiotic with product. It's got so many global issues. I mean, what are you seeing, I guess, the voice rise within these CPG companies?
I think it has to. You're seeing positions that didn't exist 10 years ago in like a chief sustainability officer. Right. Well, a chief sustainability officer is going to spend a lot of time on the packaging that just wasn't a part of the C-suite previously. And then just understanding that a lot of this was entirely digitalization was a method to improve your own in your own four walls, your own efficiency, your own throughput, your own metrics. But now we're seeing external metrics. We mentioned EPR, extended producer responsibility. There's going to have to be reporting, you know, that goes externally to the pro in whatever region to explain, this is how much material we use. This is the type of material we use. This is how much of it was recycled material. So there has to be, because we're reporting out that data that was once internal, there has to be a C-suite level or a higher level arbiter of that is what's coming and going inside and out of a building in a system.
Yeah. I mean, it's great to see that there's so much awareness at the executive level now. And I agree. I mean, to me, it's been really fun to see chief sustainability officers, you know, even people with packaging backgrounds becoming CEOs of consumer goods companies because packaging is so important. But there's still hurdles to overcoming transformation, even when you get to the top. It sounds like cost and complexity remain top blockers, even though they're the biggest drivers. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic and what you found?
Yeah, that seems to be a catch-22, and we found it in a lot of different categories. Digitalization was just one of a suite of surveys that we did, and in a host of them, we found that what was the biggest driver was often also the biggest hurdle or detraction. So a lot of it is just knowing that you have to compete, you have to be collecting this data, but knowing internally that you just don't have the resources to do anything or to act on that data. And, you know, data collection is great. Collection of clean data is even better, but do you have the internal resources to be able to turn that around and act on it and improve efficiency, whatever your metric is? And a lot of companies are afraid of, they're going to say, no, we're going to have to hire an entirely new department to be able to parse this. So the costs and everything that presents a large hurdle, even though they see on the other side, the ROI is there. And I think what that comes down to is what you just said, Matthew, about having a C-suite level champion, somebody be able to explain the ROI. Because there's a, you know, when we talk about digitalization, it's a million different things. There's a million different tactics and platforms, kind of this big amorphous thing. It's like you get this analysis paralysis of even where to start. But being able to demonstrate some wins and actually show some ROI and be able to have a champion, even at the C-suite level, to be able to start implementing some of these tactics and ideally an overall strategy within the context of a strategy, then you're starting to, again, turn that battleship toward in the right direction. And that's largely on the manufacturing side, but we're starting to see that pivot right now.
You know, Matt, it's so funny you mentioned that, because years ago at SpecRite, you know, we would talk to a lot of brand owners, especially, and they would say, yeah, like, we don't know what we're really making at that spec level. Our specs are everywhere. We don't know what the latest version is. And then they'd get really excited about moving to a software to manage specs. And they'd say, well, they'd have this realization of like, well, Laura, I just told you my data is everywhere. Like, how am I going to put it in this system? And I thought, wow, that really is the catch-22 of something like specification management. And I ended up talking to one of our customers to really understand, like, what was it like to work in a large CPG company or a mid-sized CPG company, right? Like, what's their day-to-day like? And someone who is a good mentor of mine, Victoria, shout out to Victoria. She said, Laura, I don't have a team of people to go get this information. She's like, we all know it's a problem. We know we need it. And I said, well, gee, if we built that team for you, would that help? And we actually created Spec Assist, which is literally a team of people that goes out and works with your supplier community to get the data for you. And this has been just critical at helping overcome that hurdle of like, I don't have my data. How do I get it? And it's been really helpful with EPR. I mean, the scale of which we're collecting data is unbelievable to even me, Matt. I mean, we've collected hundreds of thousands of SKUs. And when I talk to people, especially at large companies, they're like, this is impossible. And I'm like, I know it feels that way, but it's just not. And like, and then as they start getting data, they start then being able to see new business outcomes from that data. And that unlocks new value that they hadn't even thought of. So that catch 22 is just so real.
Yeah. No, I think it's, and Matt, you mentioned I think of that C-suite voice again, understanding the value. I love what you just said, is having those early quick wins shows the difference in the business outcomes. Every company's doing more with less, and that trend I don't think is going to change. So we have to just, and it's an overused thing, but we just got to be smarter, you know, do less with means smarter. And we've seen amazing, and you've highlighted a lot of it, Matt, is technology and equipment, right? The equipment's significantly different than when I got in the business. And, you know, doing a lot less, a lot more with a lot less resources around it. It's the same thing on the front office. You know, we got to digitize that and create the same efficiencies that's been felt in the backside of the plant.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
I was just going to mention that, you know, the results of our survey, you know, they reflect our readership, which is really a plurality of brands, from the most sophisticated and the usual suspects, the P&Gs and the Coca-Colas were amongst our respondents. But there is a significant portion that, you know, you go down to your mom's guacamole. That's my go-to for a random small brand, and everything in between. And there's a sophistication gradient that happens. So P&G is going to have a whole team, obviously, in multiple different levels and multiple different formats. But when you get into that small to medium enterprise, they are much more reliant, and they're happy to rely on, I think their suppliers. They're in the OEMs specifically, and I would say third-party software companies, the spec rights of the world, because there's often a team of one, and their job is to make sure that there's no downtime and that their old existing analog equipment has been running okay for long enough. How can we improve that? You know, they don't have time to devote to that to shut down the line, so they're leaning more frequently on their OEM partners and software partners to help do that. Now there becomes the ongoing discussion of the IT-OT divide. You know, once you know the operators and the engineers on the floor would sure love to be able to have their suppliers remote in and do remote access and remote monitoring and a lot of these things. But then there becomes that wall that says we can't let outsiders in. So that's another catch-22. They want to be able to lean on their suppliers, but then there's this cybersecurity wall that can be a hurdle.
Absolutely. Speaking of data, you know, and the survey showed that data and analytics was still cited as a huge opportunity. I believe it was something like 61% of companies said this is the biggest opportunity, but many are still struggling on what to do with it. So, you know, once people have the clean data, is there still kind of a gap where they need to understand how to apply it to a business practice? Where do you think it comes up short?
Well, I think, again, it's that department of one, because collecting the data is step one. Doing something with it is, and doing something intelligent with it. And I think that's where we're starting to see AI creep in here, to be able to not only decipher. I think the biggest next step is, we've heard about, we know what reactive maintenance is. That's always happened. You know, a cam breaks and you go fix the cam and endure the downtime. More recently, we've had, you know, predictive maintenance, which is great. We know if this cam has worn to down to 10% and it's going to within the next 2 weeks. So we can plan downtime. And we can you know, make sure that we're ready for that, and we don't have unplanned downtime. I think AI is ushering in what I would call prescriptive maintenance, and it's not only this cam is worn down, and you know, but it's how can we run at a slightly lower speed that won't change the throughput that much, but increases the life of the cam by however much, you know. So we're being able to prescribe what to do next, or do we change the speeds? Does the temperature of the upstream I mentioned Smucker's before, if the jelly being made upstream, if that's filled, that's hot filled at a slightly lower temperature, does that improve downstream operations and all these efficiencies? And I think that's too much data for one person, an overstretched engineer, to be able to do anything with. But AI, which our reporting has indicated is the emerging thing that's on people's minds, can help make sense of that and can help make not just improvements, but recommendations on how to improve further.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that, Matt. And, you know, if you're listening, AI is the real deal. You know, I've been in technology, you know, my whole career, and I've seen a lot come and go. I mean, blockchain kind of came and went. There's certain applications. It's not like it's changing your and I's lives knowingly on a daily basis. But artificial intelligence, it's changed how I do my job. I now can do more with less time. I mean, it's, but it requires rethinking how you do your job. And I think one of the challenges that we're seeing, and I feel certainly, is there's no one coming to like retrain us all on how to work. Like, it's so much of it's figuring it out yourself. And I think my approach has been to partner with people who are really doing this well. And that's one thing we try to do at SpecRight, is be that person to our customers. I mean, I was thinking about, there's so many times where we've said to someone, you know, I'm thinking of one person, one company in particular, they were receiving thousands of spreadsheets a day from their suppliers that were, or COAs. Yes, thousands of COAs. And I said, well, how are you looking at all of them? And they're like, we're not. Like, we simply don't look at them. And we used intelligent document processing to actually extract the data from all the COAs automatically, check them against the spec to see if they were compliant. And then we just kicked out a report of all the non-compliant COAs so that the quality person only had to look at the non-conformances and they didn't have to look at the ones that were good. And that's just an example of like reimagining a process with technology. And if you're at a company and you already have three jobs, how are you possibly thinking about that? Like, you need to be out in the market, working with, hearing what other people are doing, getting ideas, and then ultimately rethinking your workflows to become more efficient.
It's such a, and I get your insights on this, Matt, it's such a cultural change. You know, we've grew up in the business where, you know, success was overcoming obstacles, right? And that was overcoming a problem, a failure. And you just put bodies at it, you put energy at it, you put that person you knew could solve the problem at it. And I think that the speed of which things are coming at companies today is just astronomical. I can't even imagine how fast things are coming at them with changes. That's just, to me, the frustrating level, which is why there isn't a better acknowledgement of that at the C-suite of like, we've just got to change things. What Laura just said is a perfect example. Like, instead of ignoring 3,000 COAs a day, let's at least just extract them and create value and then change business outcomes so that all those things you talked about downstream start to go away. And that will allow you that time back to do some of the other stuff that's coming at us, net new tariffs, EPR, et cetera. So yeah, we've got to go through a big change. I feel it's coming, like you said, but we're still real early in the numbers, as your survey says.
Yeah. One thing I've seen, and this was in the survey, but I'd actually want to ask you guys about, to see if you've seen it in the marketplace, because I thought it was pretty insightful. We always hear about AI in terms of, you know, interacting with people and large language models and stuff. We've seen more and more of the small language model, you know, and companies just using their, I guess, their sets of data, whether that's all of their asset, you know, instructions and all of their manuals, and putting that all into one pool and potentially making some sort of internal company only a mini AI or like I call it a, you know, a CPG GPT, right. You know, that would be just based on their data. And that extends, it's enterprise wide, but it could be something that it creates a lot of parallels that didn't exist previously. And so we see it in HMIs, you know, human machine interfaces on the equipment. We see it in actually building the ladder logic, you know, AI coming in there. Are you seeing AI just everywhere at this point?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So a couple of things, and it's a great discussion. I think that, you know, again, where we see no data, there's not a lot of AI yet, right? Where there's data, to your point, and you have two different layers. You have kind of training your own models, and obviously that's what we do at SpecRight, and so that's what you're kind of talking about. Is a CPG may train their own internal data models and do some great things that are far advanced from where they were yesterday. Then you have the open AI, which is, you know, the global AI, which you can enhance or extract greater value again on top of that. So we're seeing it in a lot of places. We're enabling it a lot of, you know, we're starting to work very heavily on it. And again, to kind of create the company outcomes better, faster, as Laura said, with less work to be done. I'm excited because I think in the future, as we anonymize data, we can pull in some external AI to currency changes and things going on around the world. We're really going to give companies this really great vision of where they're at today and ultimately almost become predictable to the business where it's going to head in the next 6, 12, 18 months. As you just talked about a machinery level, I can see we can get there at a business level.
I mean, Matt, I think you're so spot on. Last year, we announced SpecGPT, which is exactly what you talked about. It's the ability to use natural language prompting with your
in
own
multiple
data.
Languages. Yeah.
Which is important. To me, this is just the tip of the iceberg because, you know, when I started my career, I did technology consulting and I was helping people with a lot of digital transformation projects. And what I typically saw was there was the business and there was IT. And if you wanted to do something as a business user, like if you wanted to update a report and add a field, you had to go to IT, and then IT would tell you it would take 2 months. And you're like, well, screw it. I'm not going to add this field then. That's just, that's not going to exist anymore. I mean, with SpecGPT, for example, you could say, create a report of everything, every corrugated spec in draft. Create a report with everything that doesn't have PCR in it. And it'll create, you don't have to go to an IT partner and put in a request. And then you can say, okay, I don't want a bar chart. I want a pie chart. I mean, you're not going to need certain types of roles anymore. And in the sense, not from the sense of like, you don't need people, but a lot of these companies don't have these people to begin with. If you're a packaging team, you don't have a packaging analyst. You don't have a packaging data analyst today doing reporting for you. Most likely you don't. And this is going to enable people to unlock more insights from their own data. I mean, we've heard a lot of feedback of people saying, you know, because tariffs, I went to our customer base and said, how big of a deal is this? Is it hair on fire? Is it you're a little nervous? And one of our customers was like, we just started looking up everything we made in X in China. And like, we could instantly see that. And it was easy to do. And that's because they have the information to begin with, and it's their proprietary data, and then they can query it however they want. I mean, Matt, the future that I see here is just so exciting because, you know, AI isn't just prompting a chat in a smarter way. I mean, I'm sure many of us have used ChatGPT. It makes it so much easier to search for information, and we kind of are already applying those things to spec, right? I'm excited about AI agents where you can then have it go do something for you. So let's say, you know, you work cross-functionally and you're like, hey, I want to create a new approval process when we launch new packaging. And first, I wanted to go to Susie in new product development. And after Susie approves it, I wanted to go to Mary in quality. And after Mary, I wanted to go in Tim to production. And no one has to do, like, the AI then just says, great, I'm going to go build that workflow for you. And so, I mean, this is going to completely transform and make it so much more accessible for people to continuously change and update their business processes as the world changes. And so this idea of agentic AI, you know, natural language prompting and processing, it's just going to make it easier for regular people to do more, to unlock more value. And it's exciting.
It's going to allow that. And then secondarily, it's going to allow the workforce that's coming into the workforce today to do what they know how to do. You know, the next generation doesn't understand how to do things the way we do it and shouldn't. And I hope they don't. I hope they force behavioral changes. And that is that things happen, ChatGPT, things happen through AI, and you get a lot more done with less.
Yeah. Matt, you know, I'd be remiss to not cover this topic. We've danced around it a little bit. Sustainability and EPR. I mean, how are people thinking about digitization in that regard?
Yeah, well, the reporting element is huge. With EPR, under the broader EPR, I guess, umbrella, there's this concept of eco-modulation where you are essentially, it's carrots and sticks. Your reward is the wrong word, but for the sake of conversation, you're rewarded for, or you have a lower price for using certain materials and a higher price or tax, or however you want to phrase it, a charge for using other materials. So just knowing what materials you're using, especially a brand that has a wide variety of SKUs across countries, across locations, you know, what's coming in, what's going out, being able to digitize that in such a way that you can calculate and manipulate that to improve and lower our cost, which ideally is there's going to be some pay into the pro, the producer responsibility organization, because that's building the downstream infrastructure. I think another interesting element on this would be downstream at the MRF level, being able to sort better and using AI and digitization there to be able to actually relieve some of the burden. We as humans, to this day, I should know what to do with a thermoformed clamshell, PET, and I hover above the garbage or above the curbside. I don't know as somebody who swims in this water because it varies, check locally, that sort of thing. But what if downstream into the MRF, you know, into the sortation, you have the digitized AI optics that are able to say, this is PET, this should go to this stream, this should go to the other stream, and basically cover all sins. And I think that's what AI does, is it allows us to delegate the things that, you know, we're are just taking up time and brain power and allows us to focus on things that are uniquely human in order that humans need to accomplish. So, like you said, Laura, it's just extremely exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else, Matt, you want to share from the report or all the great work you're doing at Packaging World with our listeners?
Nothing specific. I just wanted to bounce one thing off of you to see if you guys were seeing. This is sort of a microcosm of AI, and it's been around longer, and that's digital twins. Mm-hmm. The idea of a digital twin. In this, we mentioned that recently there hasn't been a ton of packaging innovation, just because people have been hair on fire trying to keep up with supply chain shocks and that sort of thing. And then when digitalization was rolling in, it was more on the business side, EPR. But now that it's rolling into the manufacturing side and down to the packaging, we're seeing, we think of AI in terms of machinery, or we think of digital simulation in terms of OEMs building equipment. But I think more brand owners are using AI digital simulation to really try and compress that time, that innovation time, the time to market on a new product and package, and remove risk from the process. Because if they're able to digitally, without cutting metal, without doing any prototyping, without building a mold for a new bottle, if they're able to digitally validate that this is going to, this is going to work, it's going to survive the shipping process, you've got a higher confidence level on whatever you want, whenever you embark on a new let's say new package design, new product design.
Yeah.
So it's both a risk reducer, and it compresses innovation, compresses time to market on new products. And I think that's all. Are you seeing the same thing? Because you are writing, or you are housing the specs as these new specs are coming off being created.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Matt. I mean, I was at General Electric when they first launched digital twins for machinery and equipment, and I remember how exciting that was. And I almost think we also did a disservice to the whole manufacturing community of like what a digital twin is, because I remember we'd put up pictures of pretty machines and show data on them, and it almost seemed like digital twins were something that like you kind of see as the product, right? Like a picture of it. And a true digital twin is the data model behind your product. And so in SpecRite, to your point, you have the data model for your packaging, your corrugated chipper, the resin, the every single component part of it. And a lot of our users are doing exactly that. So they're saying during the product development process, okay, we could design this package two different ways. And let's create the data structure for what that packaging would be. Let's work with our suppliers. Let's use different materials. And then let's run that through an LCA. And let's compare those packages side by side before we do anything, before we go to prototyping, before we do a line test. Let's look at the data and see what the data tells us. And then let's select the one that aligns with our business goals, because you and I both know there's not a one, it's never like yes or no, right? It depends on what you're trying to optimize for. And we're seeing it fundamentally shift the cycle times for developing new packaging, reducing costs, because the cost to do a production run and to try something, there's real cost to that. So being able to get those development insights before you even go to production or testing has just been a game changer. I mean, Matthew, you've done so much more of this than I have. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think again, it harpens back to everything on the talk track. It's also a cultural change. Like, there's so many people that are kind of tried and true for many years of their 87 process steps that they need to run through. That's not the world today. That's the concept of digital twin. Maybe it's three process steps. And to your point, Matt, it's at a higher efficiency rate of success. And so, again, I think it's just bringing these tools to bear and challenging people of how they're doing things. You're not going to keep up today with the demands going through the 87 process steps you did historically.
Yeah, and I would take it a step further too, because digital twin is the starting point, and then you start to talk about digital thread. And so, Matt, we work with some companies that are really on the bleeding edge of this. A lot of the larger CPGs especially, I'm sure you speak with many of them. And what they're doing is they're taking that digital twin of the packaging and then they're connecting it to the line. And they're saying, can this package run on this line? What package is made by what supplier? And so they're creating this digital thread that goes across their whole supply chain. And that's, I would say, a very high level of maturity. But it enables them to understand, like, could we lift and shift this product to a different manufacturing facility? Because you and I both know, oftentimes you don't have the same equipment in every single facility you have. If you're a Fortune 500 CPG, you have 100 different manufacturing facilities around the world. You don't know what palletizer you're using in Brazil. I mean, but you can. Like, if you start to onboard this data connected to your packaging, you can go, yeah, chief procurement officer, we simply can't do this in this country or in this facility. And so, you know, there are amazing outcomes when you get that digital twin, if you will. You get those product and packaging specs digitized, you start connecting it to your equipment and machinery, you start connecting it through the supply chain. It creates visibility. But, you know, for everyone listening, I would just say, just start. I mean, all this sounds so intimidating, but, you know, there's this concept of a learning curve where when you start this process, it feels steep, but you get to the point where it hockey sticks. And I see it in companies all the time. You know, I get to see them at the beginning of the process where they're like, there's a lot of angst, there's a lot of stress. And then a year later, they're like, they're flying. And then they come to us with new ideas. So it sounds daunting, but it's really more exciting than anything. And Matt, we want to thank you for all the research you're doing. We're excited to see you at PAC Expo in Vegas. So I hope to see everyone listening there as well. Matt, thank you so much for joining. Where can people get a copy of this report?
Just go to packworld.com. There's a lot of entry points there, but packworld.com, and then there's a little hamburger dropdown that will have special reports, and this is just available for free for download. So it's all there once you get to Packworld.
Yeah, I love the work you do, Matt.
Thanks, right. Matt.
Appreciate it.
All right, we're excited for our off the shelf segment. We're going to welcome Matt Dingy back.
Always excited to have Matt.
Matt, what are we going to talk about today?
So today I thought we would go take a tour of a package from Japan. All and right. It is Kit Kat Red Bean Sandwich Flavor Edition. So it's this carton and you have two Kit Kats inside. But the real kind of interesting part to me is Red Bean Sandwich Flavored Kit Kat, which is a definite custom in Japan, a specialty there.
Yeah, I don't think I've eaten one of those. What's on the inside? Is that Thermoform?
No, it's actually it's just a paperboard carton with two inserts, which looks like there's two Kit Kat slots here.
It looks very fancy. What is that? You think out of one piece?
It looks to be that way. Yes.
Yeah. Very cool.
What I wonder. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's like a special edition pack. Matt, like, is there like an occasion use for this? Because it's a lot of packaging for a Kit Kat. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah, there are. If you go online, you can look up. There are like for people who don't live locally, it appears you can buy very fancy kind of kits like this where there's two Kit Kats. So it does seem very special occasion. But I think the flavor is consistent flavor in Japan.
Is that a gold embossing? I couldn't see again.
It doesn't look like it's embossed. It looks it's just
printed well. What era is that? Do you think is that current?
It's 2016. This one?
You know what's funny? Oh, yeah. I was gonna say, I can tell it's not current just based on the colors.
Right.
You know what I mean? I feel like the certain colors. It's not even colors. It's like the vibrancy of the colors. It's funny because we were just touring a packaging facility, and they're like, everyone's going matte now.
Going back to matte.
You can kind of look at different phases. So funny story, I just booked a trip to Japan next year and everyone's like, what are you excited to do in Japan? And I said, eat green tea Kit Kats. So Japan is famous for a lot of flavor innovation and we live in California and a lot of that innovation makes our way. In fact, I've had a lot of like black sesame. I haven't had a lot of red bean.
No,
but it's so fascinating to me how there are these local flavors that it used to be 30 years ago. We wouldn't have had exposure. Definitely. I mean, I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. We weren't
a Kit Kat.
I was having a lot of regular Kit Kats. That's awesome. Yeah. I'm excited to try some of
these. Great selection, Matt. You always surprise us. So I love not being the pre-read.
Give me a break. Awesome. Thanks, Matt. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Take care.
And we're back.